Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Alexandra Crean. I am an associate at Nixon Peabody, and I'm joined here by my colleague, Samantha Owens.
Yes.
And that's us, in case.
That wasn't clear.
Yeah. Today, you know, here is our planned agenda. We realize it's probably ambitious, but we'll try to get through as much of it as we can. Because this presentation is being given in the context of the Practice Fundamentals series, it's meant to be very high level, and it's really designed to provide practitioners who are new to the field or practitioners who feel like they could use a refresher on these things with sort of our best practices for preparing estate tax returns. Therefore, we're not going to be overly complicated and have highly complicated estate tax calculations. And we're not going to get through, I think, some philosophical questions that come up, particularly when we're preparing Massachusetts returns. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of estate tax returns and who needs to file and when, the only thing I wanted to just highlight is an estate tax return is really, it's a tax return. It is intended to be a snapshot of the decedent's balance sheet at his or her death. It's meant to show what the decedent owed and who they owed money to. Another really important thing is that estate taxes are not interchangeable with inheritance tax. Those are two entirely different things. Finally, I think it's always important to highlight that while the executor, or we call personal representative, is going to be responsible for preparing the return and seeing to the payment of estate tax, the estate might not be the ultimate payer of the estate tax. And therefore, early on, it's really important that you, with the executor, really identify who's responsible for paying estate tax. And if it's outside of the estate or it's outside of assets, you know, within the executor's control, that you tell those people that there's going to be estate tax owed and they're best not to go off and spend their inheritance ahead of time.
Definitely. So just from a very, bird's eye point of view, we'll talk about the two forms. So the first is a Massachusetts form, which is it's called the Massachusetts Estate Tax Reform, Estate Tax Return Form M706. And it basically encapsulates and calculates the decedent's gross estate worldwide. So each person who dies in the state of Massachusetts has a $2 million exemption on assets that they owned at their death. And anything over that threshold triggers needing to file an estate tax return for Massachusetts. One thing to be aware of when you are filing estate tax returns or opening probates is that the filing threshold for non-resident estates in Massachusetts or that hold Massachusetts real estate, they will look at global assets. Massachusetts will look at global assets when calculating whether or not estate tax is due. And the rates here in Massachusetts are assessed at between 8% and 16%. So on the federal side, you have the Form 706, which is the United States Estate and Generation Skipping Transfer Tax Return.
Talk about a mouthful there.
which also has a filing threshold, which is much greater than here in Massachusetts. The threshold federally is $13.61 million for U.S. citizens and U.S. residents. That's set to sunset on January 1st in 2026, and will be indexed for inflation. Something to be aware of is that, again, for non-U.S. citizens and non-U.S. residents who own U.S. assets, they are taxed a little bit differently than U.S. citizens.
Yeah, they have a much smaller exemption amount, $60,000. So if you are working on an estate where you have a decedent that has no U.S. connections other than owning property here, one, you should link up with somebody who's very comfortable in international planning. And two, you should not throw out the 1361 number. Right. On the point of residency, and particularly when we're thinking about Massachusetts residency and what that means, and then what it means to not be a resident, your residency is essentially your domicile. So it is where you live with intent to remain. It's a subjective test. It's very fact specific. And if you are filing a Massachusetts non-resident return, you will be required to submit an affidavit to the DOR, essentially establishing why your decedent should not be treated as a Massachusetts resident. It goes through a whole bunch of questions. Where they live, where they filed returns, where they voted within the past 5 years of death.
And so moving on, we'll talk about the treatment of taxable gifts in the context of the estate tax return. Lifetime taxable gifts reduce dollar for dollar available federal estate tax exemption. And so therefore taxable gifts are factored into the estate tax calculation for purposes of determining whether or not a Form 706 is required to be filed. And so the gift tax exemption really applies to transfers to other people or to trusts that are made without consideration. So one thing to keep in mind is that a donor must part with dominion and control over an asset in order for it to be classified as a gift. Gifts are valued as of the date the gift was made, and the annual gift tax exclusion available to individuals is $18,000 per recipient, $36,000 per recipient if spouses elect to gift split. There is a special gift tax exclusion available for gifts to non-citizen spouses as well, but it's much, much smaller. It's $185,000.
And I think finally, and you know, when I was a baby lawyer, I didn't always appreciate this, but now that I'm a little bit more grown up, so Massachusetts does not assess a state level gift tax like my home state, Connecticut. And so particularly for clients that are going to be Massachusetts taxable, but not federally taxable, there can really be some great planning opportunities. And later on in the slides, and if assuming we have time to get into some very simple calculations, we have a slide that will show the effect of taxable gifts and how it can reduce your Massachusetts estate tax liability.
So next, we'd like to talk about important deadlines. As you may know, the estate tax returns both here in Massachusetts and federally are due within 9 months from the decedent's date of death. Other states, that deadline is different. It may be earlier, such as in Connecticut, as you were saying. If the due date is on a weekend or a holiday, then it is due on the next business day.
Although usually we like to get it filed ahead of time.
much more in advance of the deadline. So you can request an extension in both Massachusetts and federally. And in Massachusetts, if there's no tax due, then the first extension is automatic. So you don't need to tell anyone, you don't need to do anything. You just file it within the next 6 months. However, if there is tax due, the first extension to file is granted automatically, but you do need to make an estimated payment. And Massachusetts will grant subsequent extensions to file past the initial six-month extension, but they're really granted in the Department of Revenue's discretion. Federally, the first extension to file is also automatically granted with any estimated payment. And subsequent extensions to file are granted in the IRS's discretion. But one thing to really keep in mind is that an extension to file does not equal an extension to pay. You need to ask permission for an extension to pay separately. And if an extension to pay tax is granted, you do need to pay interest on the amount owed from the initial due date.
So right now in the current interest rate environment, it can be a very expensive proposition to seek an extension of time to pay tax. You know, of course, if you're doing that, it's because there's really no funds that are available to do so. But it's certainly something to keep in mind, because the interest rate that you will owe a taxing authority is going to be more concurrent with our interest rates now. Whereas when a taxing authority owes you money, their interest rate is much more generous. So there definitely needs to be, I think, very careful thought about, you know, how long you're going to be in extension period. And then the flip side of it also is that if you are paying estimated tax, you can't just pay any old amount in order for it to be respected. You have to be at 80% of the ultimate amount of tax due. So when you're sort of arriving at an estimated payment amount, you need to be pretty comfortable with that. And I think you need to kind of strike the right balance of being conservative, but not overpaying, and, you know, not really getting much interest out of it.
Exactly. So moving on to portability. On the federal return, an executor or personal representative can make the election to transfer the deceased spouse's unused exemption amount, or what we call DSUI, to the surviving spouse. And so that election is made on a timely filed Form 706. The IRS has come out with some more relaxed procedures in terms of filing a late Form 706. I think you have something up to maybe 5 years to file at this point.
Without seeking special permission, right. Because that was why the IRS hated getting all these requests for having to file them late. And they said, so what? We're going to give you some more time so we can lighten our load. And so now you have some more time. But obviously, if you are filing for portability purposes only, that decision should really be made when you're in the heat of administering the estate and not
Absolutely.
Afterwards.
Right. So the surviving spouse can only use their most recent spouse's DSUI. So if a surviving spouse was married one or two times beforehand, they can't collect DSUI as they go along. And one thing to note is that the IRS can make the decision to examine the first to die's Form 706, really for the purpose of verifying the DSUI amount. So you just want to make sure that you know, your ducks are in order when you are making that filing.
It's sort of the IRS's way of maybe auditing a return,
right,
under the guise of, well, we need to make sure this amount's right.
Exactly. So where, you know, what numbers do we use on the estate tax return? So we always start with the date of death values, and those are defined as the fair market value as of someone's date of death, or the decedent's date of death. So the Treasury regulations really detail how you arrive at that value for certain specific classes of assets, but otherwise it would be the actual, you know, what it was on the date of death.
And we'll get into kind of how we prove out date of death value for these specific rules. Yeah. So just bear with us there. Just know the Treasury regulations have it all, but we're going to also give you a cheat sheet.
Yeah. And so alternate valuation is a possibility to use on both estate tax returns. And those values are reported as the fair market value as of 6 months after the date of death. And this can be helpful if for any reason there is some sort of depreciation of an asset. It wouldn't make sense to pay estate tax on what was its previous appreciated value. You can only use an alternate value if it reduces any estate tax due. So you still must disclose the date of death value in addition to the alternate value on the estate tax return. And if any assets are sold or otherwise disposed of before the alternate valuation date, then they are valued as of that date of disposition. So if you make a sale of property or investments than they are valued as of that date of disposition.
I think on the point of alternate value and thinking about when it may be really handy, I think we've seen greater need to think about it in recent years with a very volatile market. Mm-hmm. So if your decedent has a lot of investable assets and things that were really funky were happening in the markets, definitely think about it and at least make sure that you're exploring it.
Right.
And then very finally, if you are selling things within 2 years of date of death, there is a view that the IRS may be looking more at that as being mm-hmm. the date of death value or more accurate indicator of date of death value. And that's really because for things like stocks that aren't easily, you know, the date of death value isn't easily determined, you know, at the heart of it, what you are willing to pay for something is its fair market value.
Right.
Before we get into the meat of the return, we thought we would provide you with some basic tips and tricks. And these are things that will apply no matter how simple your estate or how complicated your estate. So first off, make sure you give yourself plenty of time to prepare these.
Yeah.
These are incredibly time intensive. I don't care how simple the estate is, how complicated the estate is. It's going to take you a whole lot of time. And I think on that thread, you know, our best practice is to really get a draft return in the hands of the executor about a month before the due date. And it's because sometimes one, executors drag their feet. They have tons of questions because they're like, what the heck is this?
Exactly.
And then I often find that there's inevitably some asset that has been forgotten. And now we need to go hunt down the value and add it to the return and then recalculate things and all of that. So just make sure you have plenty of time. Nobody likes things rushed and last minute. And I think it kind of opens up the room for errors if it's done too last minute.
Mm-hmm.
I think relatedly, you know, when we are working on things like returns, we know everything back to front, but the person who's going to be reviewing it, your IRS agent or your DOR agent, isn't going to know a thing about your decedent. So your job is to make it as easy as possible to follow. And if you do that, it's probably going to eliminate most of the questions that may come out of a return that you'll get somebody from the DOR calling you about. It's usually just they're not following the ball. So we'll talk about a little bit more about how, you know, certain places we can make things really clear. This is our best practices. We're telling you how to do things. We're also telling you what the regulations tell you to do. But sometimes you're going to have imperfect information. Yeah. It's not going to be in the form that you'd like and you prefer. So sometimes you just got to get practical and work with what you have. And understand that something is better than nothing at the end of the day.
Always. And I think that, you know, the DOR, the IRS, they understand that too. You know, they're people, they know that our decedents get messy and things get messy. So to the best of your ability that you can be prepared and be able to tell your story, the better off you are.
And, you know, and certainly if you are having to get practical because of something your executor is not doing,
right.
You know, make sure you flag that for them and say, you know, this is what we have. There's a chance it could come back and haunt us. But just so you know, the other thing that gets overlooked frequently is that the decedent always had stuff. The decedent didn't die naked in an apartment with no furniture. So as a general best practice, it's good to include an entry for the decedent's tangible items. You know, of course, if the decedent has an art collection or, you know, really nice furniture, you want to get appraisals on it. But if the decedent had probably what a lot of us have, which is junk, put some number down and have your executor confirm the number. Two final points, the one of which is on the slide and one of them's not. So the one that's not on the slide, the first few pages of a return really kind of center around biographical information. That's going to be the page that your client's going to look at very carefully because it's going to be what they know. So make sure those pages are pretty close to perfect.
Yeah.
And then finally, I think this goes towards, so this is a quote, pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. You will work on some returns where maybe it's not really settled you're supposed to do, or maybe there's arguments to be made that one position is more aggressive than another position. if you are working on a return where there is an aggressive position or bold position, I've heard that as another way to say aggressive, which I like, be thoughtful about where you're going to be aggressive and do it only in one place. Don't do it everywhere. That's going to come back and it's going to basically invite an audit. So just be thoughtful about it.
And also, just to kind of piggyback off of what Alex was saying, you know, drafting these estate tax returns really should be, you really should have a narrative in mind when you are drafting. And so your examiner really should be following the narrative as you're going along. And hopefully there's no surprises, you know, at the end or in the middle. Okay. So we will go over, you know, the asset schedules here, the anatomy of the estate tax return. This is the meat and potatoes of what the examiners look at, and also how we come to our gross estate to calculate what is due or not due. So our first Schedule A is real estate. You know, this is straightforward. This is real estate that is owned in the decedent's own name, or that they had contracted to purchase prior to death. This does not include any jointly owned property. So jointly owned property is reported on Schedule E. Here, you're gonna report any real estate at its date of death value. So you need to include a certified appraisal with your estate tax return to certify that this was the date of death value. Any unpaid portion of a mortgage is not reported here. That's reported on Schedule K. And just in terms of kind of some tips and tricks for drafting for real estate, you really want to be fairly descriptive in what it is that you're listing here. So you want to tell the examiner exactly what it is, what the property is. So whether that is it's a multifamily condo unit, or it's a single family home, known and numbered as da 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 da, more formally described by its entry at book X on page Y in the registry of deeds. And as always, you'll always want to attach an appraisal and the deed to the property so that the examiner knows exactly what they're looking at. Next is stocks and bonds on Schedule B, also fairly straightforward. Here you're going to list any interest and dividends on each stock or bond separately. And you'll also want to list any dividends that have not been collected at death, but that are payable to the decedent or to his or her estate. One thing to note is for publicly traded stocks, the fair market value, there's a little bit of arithmetic that needs to take place in terms of what you will report on the return. So generally that means you're taking the mean of the highest and lowest selling prices on the valuation date. So you really need to pay attention to what went on that day in order to come up with your valuation date. This also comes into play if the decedent dies over the weekend when the stock market is closed. And in order to calculate that, you'll look at the difference in closing prices from the nearest days that the market was open. I think you wanted to talk a little bit.
Yeah. So the one thing I will just say, so the rules that Samantha is stating are probably going to apply to most of our decedents because most of our decedents have brokerage accounts at this point. Yeah. But if you have a decedent who is high up in a publicly traded company, maybe they're the CEO or they were integral to the company being a thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they will have such a high concentration of stocks that these principles do not apply. It's not really reflective of what the true value is. And some of it is also the fact that they can't go freely trade like you or I can. So the only thing I will say is if you are encountering that situation, you are wise to speak with an appraiser and have them help you arrive at whether that's the right method for valuing shares. Because in those situations, some discounting might be warranted.
We'll talk about discounting in a second. Next will be mortgages, notes, and cash on Schedule C. And so these are notes, cash, mortgages that are due to the decedent or to the decedent's estate. This also includes any contracts that were executed prior to death to sell assets. One thing to note on the return is that for any cash, you know, bank accounts, you really want to be specific in terms of the information that you are listing on the return. We generally get that information from bank statements, which is not something that we give the IRS or the DOR. So, you know, we generally would get a statement that covers the date of death. So, but it might be, you know, over the span of 30 days. So you likely have to do some arithmetic to arrive at the date of death value. But yeah, you really just want to make sure that you provide as much information as possible so that you don't risk either of the taxing authorities coming back and arriving at some sort of different value.
I think particularly on the note piece, I feel like probably during the pandemic, so many of our clients are making loans to family members that may not be due. So particularly there, we want to make it really easy for whatever taxing authority is to follow how much is actually due to that decedent.
Absolutely. And then next is insurance on the decedent's life. Again, straightforward. You need to report any insurance on the decedent's life, whether or not it is included in their gross estate. If any part of the proceeds are not a part or not included in the gross estate, so for instance, say the insurance is owned by an insurance trust, you need to submit a statement along with the return explaining why those funds were not included in the gross estate. One other thing that comes up a lot and is kind of like a bugaboo for people is submitting the Form 12, which is an IRS form that the insurance company gives to the client or gives to the beneficiary. And we need to file it with the estate tax returns. Unfortunately, insurance companies are not very proactive about issuing these Form 712s. So even though they may have paid out the assets to the beneficiaries, they never include this form, which is essential and is well known that we need. The beneficiaries don't know to ask for it. So we try to be proactive in saying, okay, when you are going to collect this policy, which generally happens.
It's the first thing they do.
The first thing they do. You need to ask for a Form 712. And if you don't get it, sometimes it slips under, you know, it slips off our radar and then, you know, the return is due or you want to get a draft out to the client and you don't have this form and it takes the insurance company a week to get it to you. So just kind of budget plenty of time to make sure you get that form because it can hold up the filing of a return.
And I would also say, you know, at least for us, nobody dares to file a return without one. If there's one thing people don't want to risk, don't want to do, be a pig about, it's right. Filing without that form.
Exactly. Exactly. And then moving on to Schedule E. So this is where you will report any jointly owned property that is held as joint tenants with right of survivorship or as tenants in common. So I just want to note that, or I'm sorry, you're only going to report joint tenants with right of survivorship or as tenant by the entirety. You are not going to include any property that is held as tenants in common or any community property that does not go on Schedule E. So part one is qualified joint interests that are held by the decedent and their spouse. And you wanted to say something about there's some special rules.
Yeah. So I think, you know, this is the schedule. It's the joint bank account. It's the joint brokerage account. But if you have a decedent that's not married to a U.S. citizen spouse, you shouldn't expect to be able to just report, you know, the decedent is owned as treated as owning half. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in that situation, a very unhelpful presumption is applied, which is unless you can prove that the non-citizen spouse has contributed funds towards the bank account, the house they bought together, the brokerage account, whatever it is, the decedent is going to be treated as the 100% owner of that asset. So just to the extent you encounter that, it is just something to keep in mind. And, you know, good luck trying to get a spouse to maybe help you prove that out. So you may need to be prepared to report the full amount and just move on.
Mm. Yeah. Part two of Schedule E is all joint interests that the decedent held as a joint tenant with rights of survivorship or as a tenant by the entirety with anyone other than their spouse. And one of the biggest mistakes that we see here is that you do need to report assets at their full market value, not just the interest that the decedent owed. And Schedule F is other miscellaneous property. So this is our catch-all schedule. This is where you will report any debts due, any business interests in, you know, whether it's a partnership or a closely held business, any insurance that the decedent owned on somebody else's life, or any shares in any trust funds. With respect to the business interests, those will always need a certified appraisal. And as Alex said, you know, sometimes your business interests or partnership interests, they might not actually be worth what you would pay for an appraisal. And so that kind of harkens back to our point about being practical. So to the extent that you can give the taxing authority as much information as possible so that they can see, you know, whether it's income tax returns or you know, whatever it is that you can gather in order to show them that the interest is there. It really wasn't worth us getting the appraisal, but we tried our best. That's great. Let's see.
But obviously appraisal is a gold standard.
Yeah. Yes, of course.
And we should say that in the first instance. But yeah, sometimes, or again, the last minute interest is always those funny real estate partnership interests, and you need to do something in the meantime.
Right, exactly. And so I, you know, you'll also, in terms of any discount, you mentioned discount earlier, we also need to kind of spell out exactly what that discount is and how we arrived at the discount. So in addition to any appraisal that you are including in, on your state tax return, you also need to include a separate statement that really spells out why a discount was warranted and how you arrived at your valuation. So Q-tip property may or may not be included, you know, includable in the decedent's gross estate, but if it is, you would report it here. Any tangible personal property, as Alex mentioned before, you know, decedents, they don't die with nothing. So anything that they had in terms of personal assets, you're going to want to report here. Any assets that are you know, somewhat valuable, so anything greater than a valuation greater than $3,000, you're going to want to include in a certified appraisal of that item. So we're talking art, we're talking jewelry. If grandma, you know, had a 5-carat diamond, you want to make sure that those assets are backed up with certified appraisals.
And then if you're lucky where you have a decedent that has really nice stuff, yeah. So items with a value of at least $150,000 and are things like artwork and collectibles and all the rest, the IRS has the discretion to send those appraisals to a special advisory panel called the Art Advisory Panel. And it's composed of people who really know this stuff and can assist the IRS in kind of sussing out whether the amount that you're reporting is really the right amount. And it's really because, particularly I think in the realm of art, the values that are being arrived at, I think, again, have sort of a subjective nature to them. Mm-hmm. And depending on who you go to get an appraisal from, they may arrive at a totally different value. So it's that IRS check. And I think if you're working on an estate where your decedent has artwork and collectibles and all the rest, I think you also want to flag for your executor that there's a real potential for audit by the IRS. Mm-hmm. Because this is the one thing besides business interests, they love to latch on to and kind of cause a stir about.
Right, because it's so subjective. So then moving on to Schedule G, we're talking about transfers made or transfers during the decedent's life. So this will reflect all lifetime transfers that were that will be included in the gross estate. So this is where you're going to list any assets that were used to fund the decedent's revocable trust, if it was funded during their lifetime, or, you know, any property that is transferred from the decedent to another person where they may have retained, say, like a life estate. And then Schedule H, the powers of appointment, you know, this really is the value of any property over which the decedent had a general power of appointment. And it also covers, you know, the extent that he or she exercised those powers of appointment before death in a way that would make those assets be included in their gross estate. And then in terms of annuities, you know, in retirement accounts, there's really very specific instructions as to how you value those assets. So I'm not really going to delve into that, but it's in the instructions.
Yeah. Just I think the takeaways is if you have your decedent has a 401k, an IRA, whatever, it's Schedule I all the way.
Exactly. So now to focus on the thing that everybody wants to talk about, which is where we save our money, the deduction schedules. So here we're just going to focus really on more of the meatier schedules where, you know, most clients are going to be taking deductions on the estate tax return, but also where we tend to see some mistakes. So on Schedule J, you're listing any funeral expenses or administration expenses for the estate that are subject to any claims. So for funeral expenses, this is really going to cover the cost of burying somebody. So, you know, the cost of putting them in the ground, having them buried in a mausoleum, et cetera. So this covers the funeral itself, a tombstone, like I said, mausoleum, purchasing a burial plot for the decedent, the cost of any transportation, and generally any travel expenses for at least for, I would say at most, one person to and from the burial site.
It's not going to cover your reception. It's not going to cover ridiculous flower arrangements. You know, maybe you can have something very modest, but it is pretty straightforward. And when you get too extravagant or you get too greedy on that schedule, you know, you're just inviting some scrutiny.
Right, exactly. And so here you would deduct from those expenses, you know, anything that was reimbursed, say by the decedent's revocable trust or their social security benefits, or perhaps, you know, maybe they received some benefits from the Veterans Administration. With respect to administration expenses, so this is going to cover your attorney's fees, so our fees. Any fees paid to an accountant, any personal representative fees if they decide to, you know, pay themselves for their services. And one thing to think about when you are looking at the expenses of administration is that you can take those deductions either on the estate tax return or on the fiduciary income tax return. One thing to keep in mind is that if you do take them on the fiduciary income tax return side, that generally is at the expense of any funds going to a credit shelter trust. But if you do decide to do that, you just need to include a statement on Schedule J, basically affirming that you have taken those deductions elsewhere. One other thing that's big that came up for us or keeps coming up for us is reasonable expenses to protect and maintain a house. Generally, those expenses are okay to deduct as long as it's within the first year after the date of death. Readying a house for sale or for a necessary sale, I should say, that also has been coming up lately. And this one's a little bit interesting. Massachusetts and the IRS have slightly different views on this, but for instance, a big thing that somebody would want to deduct is, say, a broker's commission. Here in Massachusetts, if there was no instruction to sell in the will or the trust, then those commission expenses are not deductible on the estate tax return. The IRS's position is more so that these types of expenses, in order to get a house ready for sale, are not allowed. You're not allowed to take them as deductions unless it's absolutely necessary to raise funds in order to pay for the estate tax or for any other required expenses.
And I will just add, particularly about the DOR, I've actually had them call me and say, I see these deductions you took for the real estate. Can you please show me where in your document the decedent say to sell the property?
Yes.
And at least thankfully there was in there. So I said, oh, DOR, here you go. Right. So yeah, they do pay attention to it.
They absolutely pay attention. But, again, in the vein of creating a narrative of what is going on, sometimes you need to be kind of upfront with your examiner about why exactly you are taking those deductions. So, my decedent died intestate, but was owned all of this property, was almost bankrupt, and I need to sell this house in order to raise funds so that I can pay you. And they're able to get on board with stuff like that. Again, as Alex mentioned earlier, one thing that the IRS does look at is any sort of sale that takes place, within the 2 years after a date of death, and they can come back and get you on that if they see something that they don't like. And again, like I was saying, deductions are really part of this storytelling narrative. So in my opinion, your deductions shouldn't surprise your examiner. They should get through your return and really say, okay, this is reasonable given the circumstances, as opposed to picking up the phone and saying, so why did you do this? I don't understand. You want to give them this information upfront. And then we'll go to Schedule K, which is debts of the decedent. We always get questions about this as well. Who's going to pay the debts of this person who died? Do I have to pay it? Where does it come out of? So any mortgages, any unpaid balance on a mortgage is where you're going to report that on Schedule K. Any property taxes on real property that's owned in the estate, those are also deductible on Schedule K. You may know that property taxes are assessed generally as of January 1st, but your first payment won't be due until June. So any taxes that are assessed after January 1st of the year of the date of death, those can be taken. You can take up to a full year of tax returns, property taxes as deductions on Schedule K. And additionally, unpaid medical expenses, that's always a big one. Those are generally deductible up to the year after the decedent died.
Very briefly, Schedule M is going to be its own set of slides because that's where the real fun is. But Schedule O is where you're going to report things that qualify for the charitable deduction. Decedent leaves gifts to ex-charity. The decedent leaves everything to the charity. That's where it will go. Schedule P is really applicable for your decedent that owns property somewhere else in the world and trying to claim treaty relief. On that front, very briefly, the U.S. only has a handful of estate and gift tax treaties, so you'd have to look to that in order to figure out whether that's applicable to you. And then Schedule Q is a really funny one. The only thing I will say is you need to think about Schedule Q if you have a decedent who received property from another taxable decedent who died really close to their date of death. Mm-hmm. So that's all I'm going to say on it. Just keep that in the back of your head because one of these days it'll come up and you'll be thankful that we brought it up. Schedule M. So this is going to be, so a transfer from a decedent to a U.S. citizen spouse is qualifies for 100% marital deduction. Isn't that nice? And for things that pass directly to the spouse, you're going to get the deduction, no problem. When you have assets passing to a trust for the surviving spouse's benefit, which a lot of our plans do, and that's why they pay us the big bucks, the trust needs to satisfy certain requirements in order to get the marital deduction. Things like the spouse is required to receive the income, principal payments can only be made to the spouse. And if you are administering an estate where you did not draft the documents, you better read those documents early on and confirm that they actually qualify for the marital deduction. Because if they don't, you're going to have to think about how exactly you can fix the trust to make that happen. And it may also require other beneficiaries to participate in whatever you do. Things that pass to a non-citizen spouse do not automatically qualify for the marital deduction. In fact, you don't get a marital deduction. But if you structure a trust properly so that it qualifies as a QDOT, you will. And there will be some steps that you have to take in order to show that the trust is a QDOT. You sort of look into it, transfer property in a certain way, all that. And then really, when you are preparing a Schedule M, there's going to be some really special arithmetic that's done when you have something passing into a marital trust that you're going to also have to spell out for the taxing authority, essentially how you get there. What arithmetic you do is really going to depend on your funding formula. And there was a whole one of these fundamentals, I'd say a year ago, we talked about it. So we're not going to get into it here. But just know that as a part of your preparation process, you really need to read your instrument carefully, make sure you understand how the marital trust will be funded and that the arithmetic you do matches up with that.
Right. So I see we're starting to run low on time. We've been talking a lot, but we'll go to estate tax closing letters, which is, you know, hopefully the conclusion of this whole exercise is to receive an estate tax closing letter. So once an estate tax return is accepted, the Massachusetts Department of Revenue, they will automatically send the personal representative a closing letter. You don't need to ask them unless you need it, you know, sooner rather than later. They will automatically send that to you.
And they're quick about it.
They're very quick about it. They're so great. They're so great. if you have requested a release of lien for any property that might have been a part of the gross estate, that will also be sent to the personal representative along with the closing letter. And one thing that I've noticed over doing this so many times is that you really need to make sure that any release of lien that you receive, you really got to double check them, because a lot of times you end up recording them in the registry. And I've caught several times that there were typos and mistakes that were actually, you know, mattered. And they'll fix that for you very quickly if you do catch it. But so obtaining a closing letter from the IRS, you actually need to be proactive about getting a closing letter from the IRS. You have to request it through their electronic system, and generally you'll pay a user fee in order to do that. The IRS generally does not send closing letters for estates that are filing only for portability. So therefore, you know, if you have access to the transcript delivery service through the IRS, that can be a really good tool for requesting a transcript. And it will note that, you know, the estate has been closed, or that you know, the examination has been closed. One thing that I wanted to note is that for the IRS specifically, there has been an uptick in their hiring. And so while they're training new examiners, small ticket items like issuing closing letters for estates filing for portability, they're just not doing that anymore. And they don't really like when you bother them about it either.
They didn't even like it beforehand.
Right. So they're just like, we're not doing that. And another thing to note is that sometimes Massachusetts will wait for the federal estate tax closing letter to be issued before they issue their estate tax closing letter if it was a taxable estate here in Massachusetts, really because they want to make sure that everything matches up in terms of the schedules that are reported on both returns.
And then finally, we touched upon it, but you'll bring it home, which is
the release of the estate tax liens. So really here, what I want to emphasize is that this is really important to obtain. We have come across more recently a lot of title examiners being really, really, really nitpicky about title to property that is transferred, after death. And in order to have marketable title, you need to have liens released. So as it says here, estate tax liens are automatically applied to real estate owned by a decedent at his or her death. And those are state estate tax liens and federal estate tax liens. So the federal estate tax lien only applies to real estate that's owned by an estate, whereas here in Massachusetts, estate tax liens applies to all real estate that's owned by a decedent, regardless of how title is held. So it doesn't matter if it's in a nominee trust, it doesn't matter if it's, they see through, it doesn't matter. And so you need to have lien released in order to clear title.
I was going to jump in. So obviously, if you need to obtain one of these before you receive a closing letter, you're going to have to take affirmative steps mm-hmm. with the taxing authority to obtain it. You're going to also need to have a purchase and sale agreement in hand. And if you have to deal with the IRS at all, you want to make sure your closing period is as generous as possible. I'd say at least 90 days, because the IRS will take a long time to issue one of these. The DOR is excellent. They'll basically give you one same day if you ask for it. So just something to keep in mind if you're in that situation. I think finally, this really comes up in the international realm, which is where, I spend a lot of my time, but there's another type of lien document that you may have to think about on an estate. And that is one that can come up. It's called a transfer certificate. Big banks love requesting them whenever a decedent dies overseas. And it's a special type of document that is issued by the IRS that essentially says the decedent is good on estate taxes. You can pay this account over with no problem. And the reason that large U.S. institutions request it is to essentially protect against transferee liability. I'm thinking this is a great point to see if there's any questions.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
And sorry, we're just reading them. We have one question that's really interesting. So we have somebody writing in who works for a nonprofit. Nonprofit gets plenty of bequests from decedents. And they're often told that a bequest is not going to be paid and that the funds are going to be held back for 3 years for unexpected costs. Yeah. So this is really an administration question. Because we administer so many estates, we're going to go for it. And the question is that legitimate? And why do we have to assent for funds that are legally ours? So setting aside the pay, I think when the bequest should be paid, and they're really supposed to be paid within a year, but we're gonna let that one go. We don't know the exact specifics of when attorneys say these things. I mean, it is often very common at the end of an estate when all these things have done and everything's set aside to hold some funds back, basically for the little nitty gritty things that need to be done at the end of the day. And and keeping some cushion there as things come up. Here's what your thoughts are.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think generally we want to be making requests within a timely fashion. And yeah, setting aside a reserve for any unexpected costs, but not the entirety of the request.
Yeah, but we don't know the specific there and how it all is. And we don't know if it's one that's directed to be paid or if there's a residuary amount. But yes, that's a concept. That's what we can at least say.
Yeah.
And that was really the only question.
Yeah.
So I think finally, we just have 4 more minutes. We'll give you one more treat, which is basis step up. So when you have to file an estate tax return, or when at a time when people have to do more of this, our taxing authority said, you know what? Because you filed a return and you paid estate tax, you get something special on the income tax side and you get a basis step up. And what basis is the price you paid to acquire something. And when you go to sell it, that's going to be the value that you're going to use for purposes of determining your capital gains tax. So when there are assets that are includable in a decedent's estate, you get what's called a step up in basis. And so essentially its new basis for income tax purposes is going to be all the things that you're reporting on the estate tax return. Not all things get a basis step up. I think retirement accounts are a very common one, and reasons for that are complicated and we won't get into it. Just one thing to flag is that when you have property in a marital trust for which a federal QTIP election was made, you will get a second step up at that the spouse's death. But if one was not made at the federal level, you will not get a second step up. So your mass QTIP will not get a federal basis adjustment. I think there's some arguments to be made that it gets a mass step up, but that gets really complicated on the income tax side of things. And then very finally, and then we'll leave you with that, is not that we're in community property states, but just know that when you have jointly owned assets or community property assets, you know, what gets stepped up is going to be different in those states. I think in those states, it tends to be more generous, where if you spouses own a house together, you're only going to get one half of the basis stepped up, which makes for fun when you go and sell the house. Exactly. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for joining us today, and reach out if you have any questions.
Yeah, and there we are.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.